It's Tuesday, July 16th, 2013, and you're listening to episode 304 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 4 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
And as far as hosts go, that's it.
It is pretty empty in here.
We've got two empty chairs in here and no Chris, which really doesn't change anything in terms of the dynamic of how we operate. But we do have joining us today 4 guests, and I'll introduce them one by one. What we are doing is we are going to do a roundtable to talk about Kickstarter, because obviously Kickstarter has had a pretty major impact on the course of our hobby and how things are getting done now. And so we want to talk in depth about the ins and outs of good techniques for setting up a Kickstarter, following through on it, setting rewards, and then also from the standpoint of a backer, someone who's not a creative but wants to get out there and back these things, what types of things you ought to look for, how to discern a scam, all this kind of stuff. So it's going to be a big all the way around the world sort of conversation. We've got a diverse group with us. So let's go ahead and, we'll go in alphabetical order by first name, I guess. So let's go ladies first. Joining us first is Joanna Gaskell.
Hi.
Next up is Matt Forbeck.
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Third is a man who has been on the show before, once described himself as Fear the Boot's biggest fan and clocking in at 7'8". I believe it's absolutely true. Mr. Ryan Dancy.
Hello.
And last up, we've got Tom Lommel, who you guys probably better know as Bill Cavalier.
Hey, everybody. I'm glad to be here, and I just want it to be known that I'm 7'9".
Ooh. And still rocking sweatbands 30 years later.
It's true.
Tom, I do have to give you credit for that. As a child of the 80s, I want to say that I really appreciate you bringing sweatbands back here in the year 2013.
I think...
Speaking of Kickstarters, I want my sweatbands, Tom. They better be in the mail.
Yes. You know what? I'm knitting them furiously as we speak. So if you hear clicking in the background, that's me making Joanna's sweatbands.
Yes.
It's like she's foreshadowing a future topic.
Ones you've worn and sweated into should be a top-tier reward.
I have no comment on that. I would be interested to find out what kind of fan is interested in that pledge level.
You will find out. All right, so let's go ahead and run down here real quick. For any of you that are not familiar with any of these names, I want to run through real quick and get an introduction from them on who they are, where they've been, what they've done, who they've killed, how you can prove it and blackmail them for tons of that fat RPG money that they're all sitting on. And then, of course, also what their context is with Kickstarter. So we'll go in the exact same order. Joanna, where are you from?
I am from Vancouver, Canada, for location-wise. I am the producer and the writer and one of the lead actors in the web series Standard Action, which is a D&D role-playing game-based comedy web series. I'm also the co-host of Starlit Citadel Reviews, which is a board game review show, which is in its second season, and we have about 70 episodes up of that right now. That's pretty much where I'm coming from. I'm not going to tell you about the people that I've killed, because that would be silly. Why would I tell you that? I've gotten away with it so far.
You have a web series recording it.
Yeah. That's film kills. You're not allowed to count those.
It's like boxing, or if you kill somebody in boxing because you got a fight license, it doesn't count.
Well, that's what I'm hoping. I mean, otherwise the police are on their way.
I'd still count it.
Joanna, am I correct that you've got a YouTube channel that all your stuff is on?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you can find all the Standard Action stuff at standardaction.com. That's probably the easiest place to go. We do have a YouTube channel, but that website will take you straight to it.
Okay.
And Starlit Citadel, you can find, on YouTube. Just search for Starlit Citadel and we're all there.
And then Joanna? Kickstarter.
Yeah.
You guys recently funded your current season through a pretty successful Kickstarter. You want to talk a little bit about that?
For sure. It's our first time running a Kickstarter. We have done crowdsource fundraising before, but this is our first year with Kickstarter. So we ran a fundraiser for our third season of Standard Action. It just finished mid-May. And we got something around 300% on our Kickstarter. So it was very successful. Yeah.
Excellent. All right, Matt, you're up next.
My name is Matt Forbeck. I started out in the role-playing gaming industry back in 1989-1990. I used to run a company called Pinnacle Entertainment Group that did Deadlands, Brave New World, a whole bunch of other games. I've written stuff for several editions of Dungeons & Dragons. I wrote a game called Brave New World for Pinnacle that then went on to be sold by AEG. And I ran 4 Kickstarters last year, in an effort to run a challenge I called 12 for 12, in which I challenged myself to write 12 short novels in the course of a year and managed to break them up into trilogies and fund every one of them quite well.
Wow, that is impressive.
Yeah, I actually, Matt, I was watching your Kickstarters, and I want to ask a question here for the sake of anyone who's driving and doesn't have Kickstarter open in front of them. How long were these novels? What were your goals set at, and how well have they funded out so far?
They were 50,000 words each, so it was me challenging myself to write 600,000 words in the course of a year. 50,000 words is over the minimum required for a novel by most award systems, which is 40,000. And it's also not coincidentally the number of words that you need to write for National Novel Writing Month, which happens every November. So basically, I was trying to do National Novel Writing Month every month for the course of the year. As a total, they brought in about $60,000 for the 12 books. Each of them did pretty well for themselves, and I was pretty excited about it. At the end of the year, I only managed to write 10 novels, sadly. So I failed, but I failed well. I also wrote 9 comic book scripts for the Magic the Gathering comic book for IDW that year, and a number of short stories, including stuff for StarCraft and a bunch of other different properties.
Ryan, I have to imagine that at this point in our show's run, our audience is pretty familiar with you, so let's cut to the Kickstarter part. Obviously, one of the things that you're fairly well known for throughout the RPG industry is your interest in and continuing pursuit of an understanding of the market and financial aspect of role-playing games. And so I'm curious if you could talk for a bit about your interactions with Kickstarter.
Yeah, my company, GoblinWorks, is creating an online fantasy sandbox MMO called Pathfinder Online. And we ran 2 Kickstarters for that project, one in May of 2012 and one that ran over Christmas and ended in January of 2013. And we've raised $1.4 million across those 2 Kickstarters. We've got about 10 to 12,000 backers. It's kind of hard to tell. There's an overlap between the 2 projects, and we haven't quite figured out how many people are pledged for both. But it was a very successful fundraising campaign for the whole project. And I'm really glad that we were able to do it.
And then last but certainly not least, lest I anger the Dungeon Bastard, we have Tom Lommel, better known as Bill Cavalier.
Hello, gamers. Good to be here. Yeah, a little bit about myself. I am a gamer from way back in the day. I started when I was 14, and the next year I started going to Gen Con, and I have been going every year since. Started going the first year it was in Milwaukee. Have played all different types of role-playing games. I did some playtesting for Monty Cook, was very active as one of the moderators on his forums when he was running Malhavik Press. And I've had 2 different web series that I've been involved in.
Let me give you a little bit of marketing tip here, because we actually told this to Monty himself, so I want to pass it on to you. You could drastically increase the eyes that are paying attention to what you're doing if you change this over to be Monty Cook's Bill Cavalier.
Yeah, I'll think about that. I don't know if I can pay the rights or the licensing
fees. Yeah,
there's
approvals and licensing and everything else.
Yeah. Monty's already got 10% of my game. I don't know that I need to give him 10% of my soul.
Nothing a trip to Ecuador can't fix, but carry on. I'm sorry. Please continue.
Yeah, so I've been involved in 2 kind of gamer-related web series. One that most people may suddenly remember but may not connect me with was a thing that came out about 6 years ago called Fear of Girls, where I played Doug Douglasson, about 2 guys who played way too much live-action role-playing. And then the other one is one that I've created recently in the past 2 years called The Dungeon Bastard, where I play Bill Cavalier and I write and star in that thing and bring ultimate gaming advice to the masses.
And you very recently had what I believe to be one of the most honestly named Kickstarters ever launched.
That's right. Bill Cavalier decided to run and try and get funded the world's worst dungeon crawl. And that's going to be happening, I'm happy to say, live at Gen Con this year here in 2013. And we had 500 backers and raised over $26,000. Very enthused by the turnout by the fan base.
You know, actually just doing the mental math on that. You said 500 backers at $26,000?
Yep, that's right.
Wow. Well, okay, either you have 500 people with really deep pockets, or you had somebody in there that really wants Bill Cavalier bad.
You know what? I'm sure this is a topic we'll probably cover, but I'm not going to lie. We had an angel investor who came in and scooped up our top pledge level. You know, usually at pledge levels, you kind of like plan out to like $300 or $400 and maybe figure, okay, 1 or 2 backers are going to jump on that. And then after that, it's all just kind of like gravy. Okay, well, we'll put a $2,000 or a $5,000 thing out there and see if somebody bites on the hook. And our top backer level was Lich Demigod, where Bill Cavalier comes to your house and plays the world's worst dungeon crawl with your party and your players live and in person. And we had an angel investor who came on board and did it. He's a great guy.
That's fantastic. Wow.
You are, before you go into the house, going to let people know where you're going to be at, right? Just concerned for your own safety here, you know?
Yeah. I mean, A, number one, I've actually met the guy, and I have no concerns about my own personal safety. But even if I did, I would bring one of our producers with us. So, yeah, I think we'd be safe and sound for the weekend.
Let me start with this question. And, Matt, I'm going to kick this one to you. Now, of course, obviously, you other guys can chime in on this, but I'll just start the question with Matt. You've been around the gaming industry quite a while. How is Kickstarter changing the gaming industry?
I think it's doing a lot of good for it. I kickstarted novels instead of games when I was doing this because I've really gotten into writing novels over the last few years. Started out doing Blood Bowl novels and D&D novels and a bunch of other stuff. I wrote a leverage novel last year amongst the other stuff I was writing. And I think one of the things that Kickstarter allows you to do is go from saying, hey, I got a great idea for something to now I can actually pull it off, right? And you had a whole class of people there who had the skills to pull these things off, to do not only the design, but the production and the artwork and get things into people's hands, but didn't have any of the capital required to even take the month or two or three or four or whatever it was going to take to actually do these things, to actually pay people to help them out with the artwork. And this allows them to do that without mortgaging their house or their retirement fund or borrowing money from their friends and family and then ending up having it all get destroyed and lost and not being welcome at Thanksgiving anymore, right? So the gaming industry is actually fractured into two sections, as is most of entertainment, where you have very large hit makers like Wizards of the Coast and Paizo, and then you have just this swath of people at the lower level, right? So you have the huge hits and you have everybody else. The indie movement is really helped out by Kickstarter. I mean, even White Wolf is considered an indie movement nowadays. But even though they just broke the record for Kickstarters for role-playing games, well, the Onyx Path did, which is the new White Wolf guys. But even so, you know, when you raise $500,000 on Kickstarter for a White Wolf product, it's mostly through nostalgia and stuff, but that's not what you consider a large business. Hasbro would kind of laugh at that if that was your entire business for the year, right? So it's neat to see people have this kind of an option of being able to reach out directly to their fans and get funds for something that everybody wants to see.
So besides funding, I've noticed another benefit to Kickstarter. And there are a lot of projects I would have never heard about if they hadn't hit Kickstarter. And I'm wondering if that's something you've seen as well. Just by the nature of Kickstarter, people are constantly watching it, sharing links. You can go out to Kickstarter and click RPGs and see all of these. Is it also thought of as potentially an advertising tool for an indie release?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially a group like White Wolf, even over at Paizo, these guys often maybe don't need all the money. It's that they would like to have the money, but they could probably find angel investors or whatever to handle a lot of this stuff for them. But the marketing value of having everybody buzzing about how well you're doing with your Kickstarter for a month is fantastic. And it does take a lot of the guesswork out of it, right? One of the great things for me for Kickstarter is realizing that you can tell fairly well whether or not something's going to succeed or fail within 30 days. And you only have to put in the amount of time and effort that it requires you to put in the pitch, right? Whereas opposed to the old way, which was find investors, mortgage everything you can, put all the work in, put all the sweat in, get a booth at Gen Con, hope the distributors pick you up, hope the retailers actually buy you, hope you can find enough of a network of players that are actually going to buy into your product, and then maybe make your money back if you were lucky. Nowadays, you can tell within 30 days if you have a shot in hell of pulling that off. I mean, it's not a guarantee of actually having a successful business, but it's a guarantee of actually getting your minimums to the point where you can survive with what you're doing, as opposed to the long, slow death march that we saw a lot of companies go through before that.
If I can jump in on the flip side of this, I think that Kickstarter forces you to do better marketing because there's no other way for you to really spread the message about your product other than getting people to talk about whatever your project is and figuring out creative ways to do that. Because right off the bat, you burn out your Twitter feed and your Facebook feed of like, okay, here comes another post about the Kickstarter. You don't want to, you know, alienate the fan base that you have. So I really think by virtue of doing a Kickstarter, it forced me to innovate in my marketing approach and do far more marketing than I would have normally done just to support my series on its own as somebody who's an independent creator.
Oh, I agree with that entirely. I think the ticking clock aspect of Kickstarter and the all or nothing aspect of it too, right? That you either succeed and do well and go on and do the product, or you get nothing and you go home and try something else again. The pressure that puts on you is the kind of pressure that inspires you to do those kind of things, to take the kind of chances, to put in the extra effort you need to. Because you can tell yourself that it's only until this is over, buy, as opposed to doing this forever for the rest of your life. But it's too easy to put out a product and then say, okay, I'll get to the marketing later. I just want to put the best effort into this. But when you're doing a Kickstarter, that is marketing for the entire month. You're trying to do as best you can to sell the idea that you have.
Right. And obviously, as of right now, Kickstarter is the 800-pound gorilla. But I certainly do want to mention that while we're talking about this as Kickstarter, I guess in the same way that you could talk about online book sales as Amazon or online auctioning as eBay, that doesn't change the fact that there are other sources out there. For example, Indiegogo is fairly well known. Indiegogo, unlike Kickstarter, is not an all or nothing. If a project partially funds, it's my understanding of Indiegogo's model that you do get that amount of money, whatever percentage that may have been, which of course brings up new questions like, okay, if it was $10,000 for this project to happen and the person raised $3,500, what's happening with that money? Is the project getting made at a lower budget? Is he or she pocketing it and just running off to Ecuador? What exactly is going to occur there?
That's why I'm more likely to give money on Kickstarter, because I know my money's not going anywhere unless it's successful.
Yeah, it's higher profile and perhaps a little bit better vetted, but I don't want to bash these other options. Because, for example, one of the things, at least as far as I understand it, that Indiegogo does better is they work a little bit more broadly across national lines than Kickstarter does.
Yeah, that was true up until recently. Kickstarter did open a UK branch, and I just saw another one that was from Japan. But, I mean, they're allowed to take money in UK pounds now as well as US dollars. One of the reasons people use Indiegogo as opposed to Kickstarter is because Kickstarter is for creative projects only, whereas Indiegogo can be used for charities and for all sorts of other different ways to raise funds. And they do have what they call the flexible funding campaign, which is what you're talking about. You could do a Kickstarter-style campaign on Indiegogo, which is an all-or-nothing kind of campaign. But a lot of people go with Indiegogo because they can do the flexible funding. If you fail to reach your flexible funding goal, they take 9% from you, I believe, as opposed to 5%. And then, of course, is the processing credit card fees on top of that as well. So you do get your money, but you get less of your money if you don't make your goal.
We actually did an Indiegogo for our season 2 for Standard Action. Mm-hmm. And the marketing, like all of that is true. Everything that's been said is true because Canadians can't use Kickstarter. The marketing scheme is entirely different because there is that flexible funding option. And we did use that in Indiegogo when we came into our season 3 and we were deciding on which way to go, whether we were going to go Kickstarter or Indiegogo. The actual marketing plan right from the beginning was entirely different because you do have that feeling when people like investors come to the site or fans or whatever, and they look at it and they say, OK, well, what are you going to do if all you make is half your goal? Well, that means that probably you're going to choose a different total to aim for. It probably means that you're going to approach the fans differently. It probably means you're going to give different kinds of information to them. And so it is an entirely different system if you choose to go that way.
Do you have the temptation to just put the rest of the money in yourself as it gets close to backing but isn't quite there yet?
Yes, absolutely. There's that option with anything. Kickstarters too. There's always that thing that you got to get over at some point where it's like, no, I will wait to see if we can make it.
I won't pillow stuff this. And I've actually seen a few campaigns have been accused of that, where they got close to going to make it and got pillow stuffed. And I don't know how true or not true it is.
There are clearly some campaigns where that has happened. I did a breakdown of the top 10 novels on Kickstarter on my website at forbeck.com. And you could go down the list, and there's somewhere they only had a very limited number of backers. They managed to get their goal by a tiny percentage point, and because of that, their average donation per backer was well over $100 and often into the $200 or $300, right, for novels. So you were pretty clear that somebody's brother, mother, sister, wife, husband, whatever, stepped in with a checkbook at some point and said, here, let me take care of that for you, make sure you're not embarrassed. I think it's a dumb idea because basically you're giving 10% of your money away right then. You'd be better off canceling the whole thing, running it again at a lower rate, or doing it at flexible funding on Indiegogo and saying, look, we already have the money we need. We're just looking for pre-orders. We're looking for marketing. We're looking for help, as opposed to I'm going to stick in my money here secretly and pretend like I'm a success. And I don't think you're really fooling anybody just because the numbers on the aggregate are there for people to see.
I don't know. I think you do fool people, though. And I think it's that thing where people are really afraid of that marketing hit. Because we're talking about Kickstarter being also a marketing tool rather than just a fundraising tool. And I think people get scared. I think people say, like, they look at their campaign and they're not doing well. And then they figure, well, if it fails, then that's it. I'm done. This was so much work and now I'm not going to do it again. And I think that might be the motivation behind that kind of thing. It's just that fear for sure.
I agree. That's probably why they do it. I just don't think it's a good idea, right?
I agree. Yeah.
If you're going to fail, you should fail early.
Well, right? And this does bring up something else that I want to talk about with this idea of crowdfunding. which is that even putting the money aside, I believe that it serves as a form of validation. And what I mean by that is if you can go out there and say, I want 500, 5,000, 5 million, whatever dollars to do this, and you are able then to get people to actually come in and to do that, to actually pay it forward, it shows that you have an idea that actually has traction with the general population. An example that I'll draw on here from the video game world would be Wasteland 2, which is actually Wasteland 3. There really was a Wasteland 2 not many people know about that was done in miserable failure. But anyway, with Wasteland 2, there was a game that people had been wanting for something in the neighborhood of 25 years and yet could not get made. And when people came out in droves and backed that project, it sent a statement. I mean, really, from what I understand, it sent some genuine ripples through the video game industry because it got the attention of people to say, wow, wait a minute, there are people out there that are actually backing this. And Ryan, this is where I want to kick it to you, because if you can't answer this or decline to answer this, I fully accept that. But I'm going to ask you pretty bluntly, because I have my own guesses here. You've talked about in your blog posts on Goblin Works the budget to put together an MMO.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not $1 million.
Oh, God, no.
As a professional programmer, I know what we make. And I know how long you could hire how many programmers on $1 million. And the answer is not many and not for very long. So let me ask you pretty bluntly, was the Kickstarter, and I have no doubt that the funds in there were real and were really needed and did allow for genuine expansions of the game and the staff and the scope. You accounted for that in a pretty specific breakdown in the blog post you made. But would you be willing to comment on, was some part of that simply to prove to investors that there really were people willing to pay to see this happen?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say that bluntly. That was a huge part of the reason we did the second Kickstarter. You know, we did the first Kickstarter because we needed the money. That was kind of a time where it was going to be a lot easier for us to raise that money on Kickstarter than it was to raise it from anybody, just because the product was in such an untested state. So the tech demo money that we raised, the $307,000 we raised with our first Kickstarter, that was really capital that we needed just to get the project started and get it going. The second Kickstarter was dual duty. We need more money, so $1 million is incredibly important. But it was also a huge statement of, no, we're going to go out and say we're going to make this game. Are we going to get a large enough audience, people who agree that this is something that should be made, that they can support a number like $1 million, which is kind of an eye-popping number. And that will help us subsequently go talk to potential investors to raise additional capital necessary to complete the project. And that's exactly what has happened. So it all worked kind of as planned.
You've also done something that I realize is not quite within the scope of crowdfunding something on the front end. But I'm curious if you talk about a little bit, because, and this one I'm wagering you would, because it's hardly any secret, which is you have continued to crowdfund on the back end. After that original hit of northward of $1 million on the primary Kickstarter, through the people that have backed, and eventually I know some portion of this will go public, people can continue pledging money toward the game and getting different rewards and whatnot for that. So there's kind of this ongoing marketplace that's very similar to Kickstarter, though it lacks the finite time run and the specified goal that a Kickstarter would have.
Yeah, I wish I could claim credit for that, but I can't. A couple of projects before ours did the same, and really the most visible is Chris Roberts' game that he's doing, the kind of Wing Commander-esque game that he's doing, Space Industries. I never remember the name of this thing. So they've raised, I think, $8 million or more, and I think only $2 million of that came from Kickstarter. The rest was raised either before they did their Kickstarter or after they did their Kickstarter by appealing to their fan base directly on their own website.
That's a Star Citizen, isn't it?
Star Citizen, yes, that's exactly what I was trying to remember. So that was really kind of the trailblazer there to show that there was a continuing role for crowdfunding after the Kickstarter itself has ended. We are kind of in a middle mode right now. Our backers are able to access a tool that Paizo built for us, which allows them to manage their pledge. And as part of managing that pledge, they can increase the amount that they pledge, and they can allocate that increase to a variety of add-ons and changes to reward levels. Our intention is that we are going to take that site down, do some maintenance on it, change the packages that we're offering, and then bring it back up and make it open to the public. So anybody who missed the Kickstarter will have the ability to back the project, you know, on an ongoing basis. We're going to make changes because there were things that we put into the Kickstarter that we don't want to continue to offer. And there are some things we put in the Kickstarter that we want to make exclusive to Kickstarter backers. But other than that, it's going to basically run probably forever. It'll just morph at some point from a project backing tool to the cash shop for the game.
Right. And that was one of the things that I'm glad you mentioned, because I wanted to hit on. I'm concerned that there is something of a negative message that can be sent, because a lot of these things can be purchased afterward. If the reward with the Kickstarters are not kept at least somewhat unique, then that call to action, to use a marketing phrase, suddenly dissipates. Because it's like, well, I can get that later. Or if I'm someone that did back the Kickstarter, I say, well, wait a minute. You know, I came in with my early money and believed in you before this was a thing. And now that it is a thing, whatever it is that I got to make me feel special and to back this on faith that it would be created and all is now suddenly spread out to anyone who wants it anyway, which can potentially devalue the basic value proposition of backing a Kickstarter in the first place.
Yeah, and I also remember, because I did back the Pathfinder one, and after it was over, when they sent out the survey and you first go out and you see this new page, that's something I haven't seen elsewhere in Kickstarter either. The idea of, you have backed it at this level. What were your choices in that level? There were all of these options on the page when you get to that point and the chance to increase it. I hadn't seen that before either. That seemed like it was actual innovation when it comes to how Kickstarter fundings go.
You know, we made what I would consider to be an unquestionably too complicated Kickstarter. As we were racing in the final couple of weeks trying to hit that $1 million, we threw everything in the kitchen sink at our backers. So we ended up with a really complicated post-Kickstarter cleanup process.
And I know you ended some levels so you could open things up at the same dollar amount that had different items in them.
Our lowest dollar value reward tier, we changed. And originally it was something really generic, like we'll give you a thank you in the credits. And then we added a Pathfinder Society boon, which is a part of organized play for Pathfinder tabletop role-playing. And that was pretty cool. And we thought it was going to get lost if it was just listed in the body text, because you can't change the reward text once anybody has picked a reward. So we actually closed the first reward and then opened a second reward at the same $5 price, just so that text would actually be on the right side under the reward listings. And we'll probably talk about this later, but managing the text on your Kickstarter page as the project unfolds is probably one of the most complicated things that you have to do as a project runner. So it was kind of a hack. And I should mention, I wish I could take credit for the idea of doing a post-Kickstarter fulfillment tool, but I have to give props to Reaper. They had a fairly complicated Kickstarter as well. And that was the approach they took. They built a little fulfillment thing on the back end and had people use that to help decide which options and add-ons and t-shirts and paints and things they wanted to use for their Kickstarter.
You know, I wish I could take credit for the idea of using name reservations as a reward on the Pathfinder online Kickstarter, but I can, because I did.
You know, just to chime in as somebody who's run a fairly straightforward Kickstarter, I mean, I don't think we did anything particularly complicated with our reward levels or anything like that. I still find the fulfillment tool that's native to Kickstarter to be very onerous and clunky and difficult to use. We just sent out backer surveys last week to the people who pledged, and it was just an ongoing nightmare of a slog to get all the questions into that thing. I was really frustrated with how long it took to get our backer surveys out there. And I'm not surprised that people are either rolling their own back-end survey and fulfillment systems or using an external third-party one, because the one that's baked in is pretty lacking in some significant functionality.
Yeah, needs improvement.
Yeah, we're going to have to, like, we're doing that as well. I mean, we basically can't really send out the Kickstarter surveys until a lot of our hard perks are ready to mail, but we need information before that point, so we're running a separate survey through Google. It's really complicated. I mean, the whole fulfillment side of Kickstarters, I don't think people really realize what they're getting into when they run a Kickstarter. It's a long slog, and it's a lot of work.
On the Kickstarters I've backed, that seems to be the number one complaint when it comes to fulfillment, is that you can only send that survey once.
Let me run through a couple basic stats on Kickstarter. The first bunch I'm going to give are reported by Kickstarter itself. So this is self-reporting. And then I'm going to give a couple that came from an article that Wayne and I both saw on CNN to kind of set this up. Brian, we already know which one I'm gunning for.
I know what you're talking about.
But I want to run through these, and we'll springboard from that. We might talk about these numbers for a moment, but I'm going to springboard from that to a specific list of topics that I want to cover relating to Kickstarter, from both the standpoint of someone aspiring to do a project and from the standpoint of someone that's backing a project. So let's first go with the basics here. Off of Kickstarter self-reporting, launched projects to date, Kickstarter was launched, I believe, in what, 2009? They have launched 104,017 projects. Now, of those, only 44% have successfully funded. Okay, so keep that in mind for a moment here. So of the 44% that successfully funded, that's 43,903, only 36 were 1 million or higher. 5,000 of them were 1,000 and less. The vast majority of them, so over half of them, 28,722, were in the $1,000 to $9,999 range. All right, let's talk about the failed Kickstarters. Once again, 56% of Kickstarters fail. So 55,879 Kickstarters have failed. Of those that failed, this is something that Wayne and I were looking at prior to starting the recording. There's definitely a momentum that I see in the data, and I describe it like this. If you look at these numbers, out of 55,879 failed Kickstarters, only 348 failed over 80% funding. Okay, so only 348 came close and failed. The vast majority of them, specifically here, the exact number, 45,651, which is 82% of those that failed, failed at 20% or less of their funding goal. Ryan, you're a marketing guy, but I can't read that as anything but a sense of momentum, if not a bandwagoning mentality in the way that crowdfunding works.
Yeah, I mean, you're 100% correct. And I'll also say, I mean, this kind of builds on the conversation earlier. If you get within 80% of your goal, you're going to find the final 20%. You know, when I got to 80% of my goal, I had $200,000 to go, and I had 30 people on speed dial with $10,000 credit cards if I needed it. I didn't need it, but I was
You're going to admit you were a pillow stuffer, almost were one.
I wasn't going to lose $800,000 over borrowing $200,000 from friends for 3 days.
Yeah.
I didn't have to do that, and that was awesome. But if you get to 80% of your funding goal and your project is $7,000, you're going to put $1,400 on your credit card.
Yeah, Joanne, I'm going to kick this one over to you. I'm kind of curious about something because in watching a bunch of Kickstarters that I have either backed or been nominally involved in, for example, one of our own hosts, he did a Kickstarter. We've always noticed that it's a somewhat bimodal process. And what I mean by that is if you look at most Kickstarters, they kind of look like a great big gulch, where when it launches or shortly after it launches, so once people kind of know it's there, there's this rush of funding, things get kind of quiet, and then right near the end, there's a second big rush of funding. Is that what you experienced in funding season 3?
Yeah, absolutely. It was funny. When we started up our Kickstarter, I mean, obviously we've got the problem that, you know, as Canadians, we couldn't run one. So we paired up with a company out of Washington State called Gamerati. They're an American company. We paired up with them and they basically could run our Kickstarter under their name. And the guy I was dealing with at Gamerati, Ed, he came up to me and he said, okay, so how long of a Kickstarter are we going to run? He said, we could run 60 days. And I'm like, ooh, that sounds good. He's like, I think we should run 30 days. I'm like, ooh, that sounds scary.
Yeah.
He said, the reason why I say that is that it's going to be big at the beginning. It's going to be big at the end. And then there's going to be this desert in between where you're going to be working your ass off every single day for very little money per day. I was like, okay, that maybe sounds like it makes sense. So we compromised at 45 days. So we ran a 45-day Kickstarter. And this is exactly what happened. We made sure that we had the media lined up beautifully beforehand so that the internet was inundated with Standard Action Kickstarter news on the very first day of our Kickstarter. And we got a really significant contributions from everybody on our first day. And that was fantastic. That lasted for about a week. And then we had, yeah, this gulch in between. And all of a sudden, everything slowed down to an absolute crawl. We were all pushing really hard throughout the entire Kickstarter, but we got very little. And I got a lot of feedback from people saying, oh, yeah, I see you're running a Kickstarter. Well, you know, you've still got a month left. And so everybody waited until the end. And then in the last week of the Kickstarter, we got really significant contributions, like way more than we were ever expecting. During the middle of the Kickstarter, I thought we were going to finish up at 19 grand, maybe 18, 19. That's what I was sort of thinking. And we ended up hitting 36. So in the last week, it was just like everybody decided to throw in. And we could have probably run a 30-day Kickstarter and got the same total just because of that pattern.
I've always wondered about what causes that. And I have a couple of theories. And I'm really curious for you guys who have actually done Kickstarters, what you think of these theories. And my theories are it's a twofold thing. You have the people that want to be heroes, so they're watching it. It's like, I'm going to jump in at the last minute and help this cross the finish line. But then you have another batch of people that they support the project, but they're not necessarily going to jump in, But once they know it is funded, because there's always that jump right after it's funded, at that point, it's going to happen. Now, I want my reward.
Yeah.
And they will jump in
there. It's going to happen. My friends are going to have it. I want the special whiz bang that's only available through the Kickstarter. So I'm going to jump in now and grab it because I want to have the special power, the funny hat, whatever the heck it is that comes at those reward levels.
Well, and it may also be for people that back a lot of projects. Every one of those projects is an unknown when you first back it. You don't know if it's going to meet it or not. So you could one day have three projects suddenly fund and all of that money comes out of your account at the same time. But if you know it's about to end, you throw the money in there, it's going to come out right then when it ends. And I wondered if that was part of it too, if it's a matter of the timing of when the money itself comes out.
Well, I think there's a big push at the end specifically related to, I mean, those factors that you mentioned are all worthy and important. I think there is kind of a race to the finish mentality of now it's funded, I want to get my stuff. But I don't think you can underestimate the power of, number one, the email that goes out that says, oh, you've starred this project, remind me, you've got 48 hours left. That email goes to everybody who did that. And that is a prompt that gets you to pledge. And also, your project appears in possibly the only place on the Kickstarter website that it may ever appear, which is the Ending Soon page. You may never make it to the most popular, you may never make it to the front page or the staff picks, but you're guaranteed to be on that Ending Soon in the last 48 hours. And I think those two things are in and of itself kind of a built-in marketing tool that prompt a lot of that last-minute rush.
I'd never thought about it, but that is one of the first things I check when I go to Kickstarter's page or the Ending Soon. Because if I want to support something, I want to jump in on it before it finishes.
Yeah.
If I'm going to look at it, I got to look at it right now because it's about to be done.
It's the ticking clock thing. I mean, that's what Kickstarter does for you by having the all-or-nothing ticking clock thing. It says you have to do it now or you're going to miss out. There's a term called fear of missing out or FOMO, right, that Kickstarter basically functions on. If you lose out on that, you can maybe get the thing later, but you're not going to have the hipster sense of cachet of being in on the ground level and get all the cool tchotchkes and everything else and the honors and the possible ins that you can get by joining the Kickstarter. One of the great things Kickstarter allows us to do as creators, too, is monetize. I hate that word, but it allows us to monetize fans that want to give us more money than they could otherwise do. Like, for instance, if I'm selling a game and a game is $50, that means everybody who buys that game only gives me $50, right, if I'm selling it through a store. And there's no other way for me to make money off that game other than to sell it to those people for $50. But if you do a Kickstarter with all sorts of different reward levels, you can get people suddenly to give you hundreds, if not thousands of dollars by giving them extra special bonuses, visits, filming, credits, all sorts of things you can do with folks. And that's one of the great things for Kickstarter for creators is being able to reach out and do that. And if you don't get on the Kickstarter, you don't get access to any of that stuff because when that door closes, it generally closes pretty hard.
You know, let me actually give a real life example of the value of that. There's a crowdfunding site for scientific research, which probably many of our listeners will be familiar with, which is Petri Dish. And on Petri Dish, you can go on there and they have different studies and they have, okay, this is what we're offering or going to do. And here's how much it's going to cost. And here's our various backer levels. And one of the things that I think Petri Dish needs help with is getting down what it is people care about. For example, I was reading this one where they wanted to track, I think it was gorillas, if memory serves. And they were going to do a special on them, all this stuff. If you backed it at the really high level, they would send you something that was handmade by one of the local African tribes. They would let you talk to one of the researchers for a little while. I don't remember what it was, but just stuff like that. And you know what I was thinking? I don't want any of that crap. Let me name the damn gorilla. Let me name that gorilla, and in your research paper, in your National Geographic special, you know, if I decide to call that Wayne the Gorilla, it's going to be Wayne the Gorilla. But Matt, I think, let me kind of build off this to a somewhat more serious point. I think that is a valid point, but let me build some more serious point, which is that Kickstarter strikes me as a return to an older model of funding the arts, which is the patronage model.
Yeah.
That for years we have worked off of a relatively industrial model of I'm going to create a product. It costs me X to produce it. I'm going to sell it for X plus some percentage. And that's how I'm going to make this work. And obviously, there's all kinds of details in terms of supply chain distribution and marketing, which Ryan talks about very extensively all over the place. That leads to a whole lot of people going bankrupt and losing everything they've got trying to chase the arts in general. But it creates this patronage model where somebody who can only donate $5 can come in and donate $5 to make it happen. Someone who can donate what the product is worth, let's say the $50 price tag, can come in and do that and simply have, as Wayne often describes it, if nothing else, it's an easy pre-order.
Yeah.
But then you can get somebody who could come in and say, well, wait a minute, here is something that I would like that is worth more to me than it probably is to the creator to make. Okay, let me give some examples here. Our friend Mikey Mason, professional comedian, he did a comedy album. And one of his backer level rewards was if you backed at a certain level, you could give him a topic and he would write a custom comedy rock song on that topic. And if he liked it, it would make it into the album. And I wanted that. That was worth more to me than the album was. And so, as should come as no surprise to most of the people listening, I got him to write a song about how much I loved Unicron. And that's one of the songs on Impotent Nerd Rage, which was his first album. When I look at some of the Kickstarters of the people that are on here, let's, for example, talk about the one with Pathfinder Online. Ryan, one of the things that I love very much in an MMO, and not very many MMOs offer, in fact, EQ2 is one of the few I can think of within recent years that did. It's not the only one, but one of the few, is I like a sense of immersion, persistence, ownership. And you guys threw out there as one example, you can own a tavern. In fact, not only can you own a tavern, we will customize it. We'll name it what you want. We'll do a certain level of custom decoration on it. We'll let you pick out, you know, stock art for it. We'll give you a regular in there that you can kind of help us, you know, pick out and customize and maybe script some of his dialogue. The thing is unassailable. So long as you pay its upkeep, it can't be destroyed by somebody just coming through and being a jerk. And all of a sudden, here is an ability to create something permanent in the world. Now, if I look at what that backer level is, if memory serves, that was a $5,000 reward. Now, I do not believe for a moment that if we look at creating an instance of an inn, and I have no doubt that creating the assets for an inn in general, meaning all of its code and all of the wireframes and all that kind of stuff, I have no doubt that that is a fairly expensive undertaking. But I don't for a minute believe that creating an instance of an inn would actually cost $5,000 in human labor.
No.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, I know you well enough to know you would not have put it out there.
Yeah.
If it was a cash negative proposition, you would not have done it. Yet somebody can look at that and say, you know what, here's an opportunity for me to get something that I really want. Bill, let's go over to yours, or Tom.
I was waiting for that to happen.
I think you're hitting on something here, though, that you may not realize. What you're also giving is a sense of ownership in the product that's being released. You know, you're not just giving money. You are one of the backers. You are one of the supporters. If you buy it off the shelf, it's a product that was released. But this was a product that you helped get out. And then you have that person is now a marketing tool for you, telling everyone about the product. That's huge.
It's fantastic, actually.
Yeah, you have all these supporters and you can ignore all their really bad ideas.
Well, you can ignore some of the bad ideas. Like, for instance, when I ran my third Kickstarter, I did something called Dangerous Games, which was a trilogy of novels set at Gen Con. And I had a number of people who were interested in having themselves appear as characters at Gen Con, which I thought was a lot of fun. My top backer was Jeff Martin over at True Dungeon, who wanted to get 10 of his top players into the book. And, you know, that's something that it was a great idea. I actually worked it into the structure of the novel. And then he goes out when they're doing newsletters for True Dungeon and tells everybody about the book and tells people they should go buy it and how cool it is that he's got this stuff in the book as well. So it's a great, great synergy that develops about marketing these books and telling people about how you're so excited about it.
Sure, because if nothing else, if I paid into it, I probably already believe in it to begin with.
Exactly.
But on top of that, after paying into it, I want to validate my expenditure.
Yeah,
definitely.
I just wanted to say that I really agree with your idea or your comment that it's like more of a patronage model. You know, Kickstarter even goes out of their way to tell people that Kickstarter is not a store, although I'm on record as saying Kickstarter is a store. There's a certain aspect of Kickstarter that's not a store. And one of the things that I compare Kickstarter to is an NPR or PBS pledge drive. You give them some money, let's say you give them $100. They give you a coffee mug and a copy of the Three Tenors CD. The stuff that you get back from them is not in any way monetarily related to the amount of money you gave them. It's a thank you. It's not a commercial transaction. And there's a big part of Kickstarter, if you go up above $100 in most Kickstarters, a big part of what those rewards are is the thank you, not so much the material reward that you'll get as a part of the backing.
Definitely.
One of the really amazing things about web series is the fact that since the middleman is kind of removed, you can interact with your fans just so closely. I mean, they're all online. They're all, you know, on Twitter, on Facebook. You can talk to them directly. You know, me as the producer and the writer of a show, I can actually go out and talk to people and they know me by my first name and they'll come out to me at conventions and talk to me as if they're my friend and all this kind of thing. And that kind of relationship is really cool. And it's really helped by the Kickstarter as well. I mean, that sense of ownership thing is huge. We had big, expensive perks for people to actually be in the show, like to come and to be in the show. And they were the kind of perks where we figured, like Tom was saying earlier, there are those expensive ones where you're like, okay, we'll put them up there and then maybe somebody will pick one. They were gone in the first 2 days. And we're talking really expensive $1,000 perks to be in the show. And people just wanted it. They all want to be a part of the world. Our world is pervasive. We've got 3 seasons up and movies being written and that kind of thing. And an online text-based MMO, we've got a webcomic, we've got all this stuff, and we're saying to these people, okay, if you come on board and you be a part of our world, you'll appear everywhere. I mean, you'll show up, you know, in the tavern, in the online text-based game. You'll make an appearance in the webcomic someday. People just love it. I mean, it's being a part of the thing that they enjoy in a really visceral way.
Before I move on to the next major topic here, Matt, I want to ask you specifically, did the ebb and flow of your Kickstarters look any different because of the fact that if we look at the Kickstarters for the other three people on here, mm-hmm. they were more or less isolated events.
Right.
And obviously, you know, Standard Action might come back and do a Kickstarter for season 4. Well, I don't want to speak on Joanna's behalf, but if that occurs, that's going to be at some point out in the future. It's certainly not something so rapid fire as you doing, you know, your 12 for 12 with the novels, where you're doing these very rapid fire series of Kickstarters. And I'm curious, did the bimodality of that change? You know, did you not see the big hits at the beginnings and the ends? Did the flow and feel of the campaigns change any because of the fact that this was really an ongoing funding process spread across multiple campaigns, as opposed to being one big hit for a major item?
You know, it changed quite a lot, actually. The first Kickstarter went with the traditional model that you see where you have a big spike at the beginning, a plateau in the middle, and a spike at the end. And if you go back and do some of the research, Kickstarter actually does a post on their blog about a year and a half ago describing this exact phenomena and why you should change your campaigns from being 60 days to 30 days at maximum, right? And I decided that I was going to try it and see how it worked. And the first time it went just like that. The second time, it went worse than that, actually. I got a good spike at the beginning, and then it didn't quite get to the plateau I wanted to where I was going to feel comfortable about it. I did this funky thing where I broke them down, the trilogies down into books. And I said, okay, for the first book, this is my goal. And then the second book is a stretch goal and the third book is a stretch goal, right? And the idea was that, you know, if somebody bought in at the basic level, they would have the chance to get the other books added on stretch levels later on. But by the time I get to the end of the second one, people were going, geez, if this doesn't fund all the way through, not just for the first goal, but for all the stretch goals, I might only get one book out of a trilogy out of this, right? And so the last day of the second campaign, I was down like $5,000 on a $10,000 goal or a $12,000 goal for what I needed to get all three books funded. And I was like, oh, Jesus, I'm never going to be able to make this.
Should have called Ryan.
I actually got really damn lucky. What happened is I was tweeting about it online, and Brian White, who has run a couple of Kickstarters himself for Fireside Magazine, said, hey, you should ask Neil Gaiman to tweet this for you. Yeah, I said, well, what the hell? He's online right now. So I asked Neil to do it. Neil doesn't know me from anybody, right? We have a lot of mutual friends. We've never met. And that wasn't enough to do anything. But then John Kovalik got on with him and said, Neil, you really ought to do this. And Neil goes back and forth with him saying, but John, it looks like he's already funded. He hit his goal. But no, he needs to hit the stretch goals otherwise. And fortunately, John was able to explain this to him. And I would have never known this because John's a gentleman, except that he forgot to put the D in front of his direct message on Twitter once. I'm like, oh, okay, this is what's going on. But Neil tweeted it for me. Will Wheaton tweeted it for me. I've known Will for several years, and he happened to be online and was kind enough to do that for me. John Rogers did the Leverage TV show, tweeted it for me. And suddenly we were able to raise $7,000 in the last day and put it well over where we needed.
So your answer, if you can't meet your goal, is to have Will Wheaton and...
Yeah, big.
Yeah, you know, actually,
see, the trick is really, it's what people forget is they say, I'm just going to hammer my own network. I'm going to hammer the people I know over and over and over all throughout the month, right? But the trick is not to hammer your own network, because you do it 3 or 4 times and they know your Kickstarter's out there. They don't need to be told again and again and again. You can remind them at the end that it's about to end. But what you need to do is tap the networks of other people that you know, friends of friends, and say, okay, can you spread this out for a little bit for me? And that's when the network just grows explosively and exponentially. Continue on from that. For the third one, I said, okay, that was too screwed up. I'm going to just set a $10,000 goal for all three books. So we know that if we fund, everybody gets the trilogy, and there's no questions about whether or not they're going to get all the books, right? And that one reached its funding faster than any of the others had up to that point, and then continued to grow past that. So as I went from trilogy to trilogy, I went from having a plateau in the middle to having still the spike at the beginning and the spike at the end, but a fairly steady climb that increased in the middle as opposed to a flat plateau. And you can see this kind of phenomena in other ones if you look around that are more non-traditional, like the Reaper one that had such a fantastic method of using stretch goals to keep building up and making the great deal you had for buying the vampire set for Reaper. It started out being a good deal where you got like 100 figures for $100, right? And by the time you got to the end of it, you got 240 figures for $100. And then you're like, oh my God, I don't even paint figures. I just need to buy this to have it. It's such a great deal. And if you look at their curve, actually just kept going up and up and up and up and up throughout the month as opposed to plateauing at any point at all. It was fantastic. And of course, it spiked like crazy on the last day because of the feeding frenzy you got from people who didn't want to miss out on it.
I think Matt really speaks to kind of the three essential elements of what makes a successful Kickstarter. I mean, number one, reputation. Who is this person who's doing the project and what do they bring to the table? Do I believe in them? And who else can tweet about it that will kind of vouch for them? And secondly, I think there's a whole idea of value, like you said, with the Reaper campaign. I mean, it was ridiculous how much of a value it was by the time it was all over with. And the third piece of the puzzle, in my opinion anyhow, is having a compelling idea. You know, just something like, oh, that's too cool. I need to fund that. I want to see that thing happen. And ideally, if you can get all three of those things, obviously, then you've got a super success. But every Kickstarter that I've backed has had one of those three things. Either I implicitly trust this person to deliver, or it's such a great value that it doesn't matter if it's 2 months late or 3 months late, or it's such a compelling idea. I really believe in what this thing is. I want to see if I can get it funded.
I want to linger on that idea for a moment here, because there's something that I've been kind of mulling over in my head a lot lately. And actually, we as a show entity have been forced to really confront, and we're still trying to kind of muddle out some kind of internal policy on it. When you look back over the history of fundraising, particularly when we're talking about charities, there's a phrase that comes up every so often called donor fatigue. The idea that people can only give money to so many things, and the more times somebody comes back to them hat in hand asking for money, these people both become somewhat emotionally hardened towards that and may, depending on how much they've given, genuinely not have the funds to keep donating. And so they start to kind of pull away from that. Now, I want to couple that with another problem, because I think these two speak to the same thing, which is kind of a danger that something like Kickstarter or Indiegogo or all these sort of patron-based models could tap out the market. There's something that, I don't want to speak on the man's behalf, but I believe that Robin Laws posted a while back, I think on Facebook, where he basically said, stop coming to me with your Kickstarters. I'm not going to plug any more Kickstarters, period. Because of the fact that everybody and their dog right now is out there running them. Everybody wants to come in and take name capital and following and all the things that these people have accrued over the years and basically ask for a piece of that. And I don't think these people are per se doing anything wrong by doing so. I think, Matt, what you said is absolutely right, that you have a certain network of people that you ought to tap. But really, there's a lot of value in being able to reach beyond that network to people who would not otherwise be aware of what you're doing, but might genuinely be interested in it, and which you were able to do with Neil Gaiman. There's been multiple Kickstarters that our show has endorsed, either because we believe in the people or because we believe in the product. I'd like to believe that in all cases, it's been both, Ryan's being one of them. But having said that, it's certainly becoming an issue now where a lot of times when we open our email boxes or we go and look at our private messages on our own forums or on Facebook, you know, we have a growing list of people that are knocking on their door hat in hand wanting us to pimp their Kickstarter because they've got some great idea for something. I'm curious what you guys think about that. Do you think there's a potential here to really fatigue the donors, or I hate to call them donors because they're not donors, to fatigue the investors or the backers or whatever you want to call them. And by the way, there's this huge navel-gazing wank over what exactly a person backing a Kickstarter is. that I don't want to get caught up in. But whatever you want to call them, okay, there's a danger in fatiguing those individuals, these people with disposable income. But there's also a danger in fatiguing the social infrastructure that gets the word out on these Kickstarters. You know, if everybody's special, then nobody's special. If Fear the Boot stopped and plugged every Kickstarter that came to our door at the top of every episode, I don't think people would back any of them because none of them would stand out. We'd give a dozen or two dozen every show and they'd all kind of lose their significance.
And yet if we back none at all, and then suddenly one week we say, this is one we support, the weight behind that means so much more.
And I'm curious, as people that are perhaps somewhat on the other end of that equation, how do you guys perceive the situation?
I think it's already started. I think there's a huge Kickstarter fatigue. I think that Double Fine is at the vanguard of this. Double Fine broke Kickstarter wide open when they did the Double Fine adventure game and raised $3 million. And now they're in the throes trying to fund their second project, the Massive Chalice game. They're over $1 million. I'm sure they're going to finish really strongly, but I suspect that they were expecting that the success of their first Kickstarter would give them a much bigger hit on their second Kickstarter. You know, I've gotten to the point now where I won't recommend any Kickstarter because somebody asked me to recommend it. I only recommend Kickstarters that I back. And I think that there are a lot of people out there who have backed a lot of Kickstarters in the last year, and they may or may not be happy with what they got out of backing those Kickstarters, but they're probably looking at that bill and thinking, wow, I spent a lot of money on Kickstarter that I hadn't probably budgeted for. So I think it's a real thing. I think it's a big deal.
Yeah, you hit a big word that is what I keep looking back to there, that they're unhappy with what they got. I would add, if they got anything.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So
The CNN article.
Now, this was back from December 18th of 2012. Okay, so this is, by this point, about half a year old. But its basic point, I think, is valid. They looked at what at the time was the top 50 projects on Kickstarter. And they looked at how many of them actually made the mark in terms of they said they would have Project X in somebody's hand by date Y and how many of them did that. And what they found was 84% of projects are delivered late. Now, there are not terribly good statistics on this because of the fact that so many projects are in flux and in development and so on and so forth. But from what I have observed doing a little digging around, the good news is it appears that only a minority of projects never deliver at all. Now, there are certainly those that don't. And we'll talk about that in a little bit here about how to kind of spot some of those scams or protect yourself from something that's maybe not even a scam, but just isn't going to pan out. But the bad news is only a small percent actually deliver on time. The vast majority of Kickstarters are delivered, but they are delivered late. And by late, I don't mean like a matter of days late. I'm talking months, possibly even a year or more behind the originally planned schedule. The one that blew it wide open, to be honest, I don't know where they're at right now, but Double Fine Adventure, as of the writing of this article, was actually one of their lowest ranked ones for being so far behind schedule, despite, you know, having that massive backing that it
maybe
really...
Because of having that massive backing.
That's their argument, right? Their argument is we had a bunch of stretch goals and we met them. And so the project scope enlarged so much that we had to push the deadline back. That's their argument.
That's something I've looked at projects I've backed, and I don't always get excited about the stretch goals because I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, if they hit this stretch goal, that's going to be another 2 months before I actually see this. Purely anecdotally, I've backed about 10 projects and I've gotten whatever the item was from 3 of those 10. And I know personally, I get a little bit fatigued on that. When I look out there, it's like, well, I want to back this, but I'm not going to see anything from it for the next year, year and a half, if I'm lucky.
So, Ryan, I have to say that in observing your Kickstarter, you seem to have at least partially mitigated that by moving the work elsewhere. I noticed that a lot of the stretch goals for Pathfinder Online didn't involve Pathfinder Online.
You are correct, sir.
Yeah, tell me I'm wrong, because I don't have them memorized off the top of my head. But, you know, of the ones that I recall, they weren't things that were going to be incumbent upon the development team to create. these are things that are going to be incumbent upon your outside authors and whatnot to come in and write dungeon adventures or write novels or whatever. These stretch goals that we're offering really not work that was supplementary to the primary offering, but work that was almost, I don't know, really only even vaguely related.
Hey, you're interested in the MMO. Here's a copy of the physical book.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Hey, as much as I say that, I was excited about the item for Pathfinder Society. When I signed up, that was one of the things I was looking at that I wanted.
I mean, I have to point out that we actually had almost no stretch goals in our Kickstarter because we didn't get funded until the very last day. So, you know, this gets back to the comments we were talking about earlier about people delaying until the end. We actively fought that trend for the entire Kickstarter, trying to get people to pledge for our project before the last day. So we have and do have ideas for stretch goals and things that we will do with the actual video game project based on the funds that we're still raising as a part of our kind of follow-on. But in the Kickstarter itself, before we hit the funding goal, that $1 million was already budgeted. So we didn't have a lot of wiggle room to say that if we get to $500,000, we're going to add this. If we get to $750,000, we're going to add this. We didn't have the ability to add anything to the project. That $1 million was kind of the minimum amount of money we thought we needed to raise on Kickstarter before we could start adding things to the project itself. So we really had to brainstorm, how do we give people an incentive to pledge for this project until the last day? And one of the things we came up with was, you know, what are the kinds of things that people who are backing this project are likely to be interested in that we can put a price on and know that when we make an offer to have people do this, that the follow-on price isn't going to kill us. And B, it's something that people are going to be interested enough where they may say to themselves, okay, now that they've made this part of the project, I'm going to go ahead and pledge because I really want to make sure I get that thing. So we did have a bunch of stuff in our Kickstarter that had nothing to do with our game. We did a bunch of tabletop hobby products. There's role-playing products. There's miniatures products. You know, there's just a bunch of stuff like that in there solely to engage with people to get them to back that thing because there's a huge momentum play, and we wanted to get the total as high as we could to help people believe that the whole project would be funded. And I suspect that you're going to start to see things like that becoming more common in other large Kickstarter projects just because it makes good sense.
And one of the ways that you approached that was the daily rewards, where you because typically with the Kickstarter, what you get is based on what you pledge, but you took the approach of actually offering rewards based on both what you pledged and when you pledged.
Yeah, we had a promotion in our Kickstarter called the Daily Deal. And the way that promotion worked is that every day we revealed a new Daily Deal item, which would be a virtual in-game item in the video game itself. But you only got them beginning on the day that you pledged. So if you waited until the end of the campaign, you would only get one item. You would get the item that was made available on the last day. If you pledged early in the campaign, you could get up to, I think there's 35 of them or 30 of them. So it was a huge incentive to people to say, don't sit around watching this project. If you think you're going to back this thing, back it right now and get yourself, you know, in line to receive all these items. And of course, there's a lot of things are involved in the calculation around that promotion, like people don't really think about this all the time, but you can just cancel your pledge on Kickstarter. So part of the message we were sending people was, this isn't a risk. You're not risking anything. If you decide to back this project today, if you get to the last day and you decide you don't like it, you can just cancel your pledge. You haven't lost anything. But if you don't back the project today, you will lose access to these daily deals. And then, of course, on the back end, as we got closer to the end of the project, we have an ongoing community management problem, which is, I'm one of your biggest fans. I just found your Kickstarter. It's not fair that I can't get all these items. So there's definitely a lot of pluses and minuses that had to be managed around that particular promotion.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.